K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I opened with Seventh Fire. Yes, Te Miwich, yes, from their CD, The Check is in the Mail. And they are from the Ojibwe Nation. Well, I kind of changed my show around yesterday. I was getting ready because, you know, I found this essay by Brandy Morin, I could really relate in so many ways, you know, having, you know, my mother tried to raise me Catholic. Yes, I'm one of those ones that got kicked out of Catholic school, et cetera. And even though my mother had, you know, been in, her parents died when she was 15, so she was, you know, put in the convent with these nuns, and she used to always say, oh, those nuns were so terrible, they were so mean, they were so horrible. But she could not ever let go of the indoctrination that they did with her and that religion. And, you know, religion, it's man-made. It's just something that man has made up to control you, make you think, you know, and their way, as opposed to spirituality, which just is. Spirituality just is. So I found this article very, very interesting. And I've always heard a lot of Native people say they really try to learn their language because if they weren't raised with it, because they feel it's important to, when they face the Creator, that He will understand them when they speak their language, as opposed to a language that He doesn't understand that was given to them. But she said, it's entitled "The Cross They Used Against Us." She goes, "It's Sunday. I'm sitting with my faith again, the way you sit with something you love and keep returning to no matter what. I've wrestled with this my whole life, repentance, obedience, the wrath of God, that particular cocktail of fear and devotion that was poured into my people like something holy but tasted like something else entirely. I think I inherited some of it from my kokum. She was my beloved grandmother, fierce, loud, passionate, beyond measure. When she laughed, I swear the walls shook. She loved music, old honky-tonk songs, big chaotic family gatherings where you couldn't hear yourself think and didn't want to. She loved hard. She accepted me without question, never looked at me sideways for being a young, single mother of three by the time I was 24. With her, I was safe. I was seen. She was also an alcoholic her entire adult life, and she was a residential school survivor who called it only the convent. Those two words carry everything she would never say out loud. That there was a pattern she repeated her whole life, a kind of terrible rhythm I came to know by heart. Devotion to God, deep, consuming Catholic devotion. Penance, sometimes extreme, prayer on her knees, mass three times a day when the repentance was fresh, confession, worshiping Mother Mary, preaching at her children and later her grandchildren, me included, about the end of days. That Jesus could return at any moment. The sky would go black for 3 days. The moon would run blood red. The earth would shake. The trumpets would sound. The glorious angels will fill the sky. It's time to repent now. Turn to Jesus. Be ready. And then the benders. Days long, sometimes weeks long benders. Honky-tonk and chaos and gone. Then the recovery, then back to her knees. She was 9 years old, maybe younger, when her father died of TB in the late 1940s. Her family was forced to leave their ancestral lands near Onaway, Alberta, and moved to St. Albert. Her mother took work in the kitchen. Indian kids went to residential school, and so went her children. The nuns separated the girls from the boys immediately. Kokum wasn't allowed to speak to her brothers, wasn't allowed to look at them. She was a little girl, and her brothers were right there, somewhere in that building, and she couldn't reach them, couldn't call to them, couldn't even let her eyes find them across the room. She didn't understand why. Nobody explained it to her. There was no explanation a child could make sense of. Just absence, enforced by this strap, dressed up as holy order. That confusion never fully left her. That grief of being separated from the ones she loved most, right in front of her, with no reason given, it became part of how she understood the world. She got up at 5 in the morning for Mass. She sat rigid in the pews because the nuns were nearby with the strap. She wrote later about how itchy the uniform was, how she would sit perfectly still so she wouldn't scratch, so she wouldn't be caught, so she would be good. Good meant safe. Obedient meant surviving. Fear was the curriculum, the message delivered daily by those who wore the cross. Obey, pray, sin, and you will be damned. Disobey, and you are lost. You will not make judgment day. You will not be taken in the rapture. So she conformed. What else do you do when you are a child and fear is the only language being spoken? Then her mother remarried. Her late father's own brother, and alcohol moved into the family like a flood. It never really left. Kokum wrote in her diary that she used to water down her parents' vodka, trying to stop them. She called the police on them as a teenager. She wrote of the burden of it, the demon of it. She swore she'd never, never become them. But the disease had already taken root. It was everywhere. The norm. The drunken, poor, unimportant Indians. Compliant. She grew up to become her own worst fear. My aunties found her scattered writings after she passed of cancer in 2008. I was 28. Kokum and I were exceptionally close. I lived with her at stretches growing up and into my young adult years. As her grandkids cycled through. She took us in, judged no one, loved loudly. Losing her devastated me in a way that still lives in my body. Her writings told the story she could never speak directly. The fear the church had planted in her never left. When storms came, tornado warnings, she would gather all 9 of her children, rubber boots, basement, candles, kneel on the floor, and they would pray for hours in the dark. The fear was constant, present, a passenger in every room in her life. It followed her all the way to the edge of her death. Every summer for most of her life, Kokum made the pilgrimage to Loch St. Anne, that sacred lake west of Edmonton where thousands of Indigenous Catholics gather each July to seek healing, to pray, to be touched by something bigger than their pain. She went year after year, faithful as the season itself, always looking for God to meet her there at the water. A few months before she died, we took her one last time. She was in a wheelchair by then, her body giving out, cancer doing what cancer does. Her kids wheeled her down to the water's edge. We were asking for a miracle. We all knew, in the way families know things that cannot say out loud, that we were also saying goodbye. I slept in the camping trailer with her that weekend. I lay there in the dark, listening to her breathe, knowing she was leaving us, the grief already moving through me like a current. The nightmares came every night that weekend, heavy, suffocating dreams I'd awake from gasping. The sadness was enormous, too big to hold and nowhere to put it. We were slowly, painfully losing her. The miracle we asked for at the water didn't come. No, not the way we prayed for it. It came later, in her own language, in her own voice, in her own time. And then something happened that I will carry until I leave this earth. In her final days, her children surrounding her, something sacred broke open. My Kokum began to speak Cree, fluently. The language that had been beaten and shamed out of her as a child. The language the residential school called dirty. The language the nuns punished her for. It came back to her like water breaking through stone, and she spoke it in waves of blessing over her children, one by one. Loving cadence, her mother's tongue, the one that holds the names her ancestors gave to the world, coming home through her in her final hours. That in what peace looks like when it finally arrives. It tells me she came back into her own, that something was returned to her the church had tried to take forever. And it tells me she is with Jesus now, her Jesus, not the one they weaponized against her. She's with her daddy, gone from this earth since she was a little girl. She is home. I love Jesus. He's my Savior. He was a rebel. He was a brown-skinned man who turned over tables and sat with the outcast and said the meek would inherit the earth. I don't accept Jesus, the Catholic Church taught my kokum, that Jesus was a tool, a weapon of compliance. Bow down. You are sinful. You are dirty. You are low, you dirty Indian. Ask forgiveness for everything you are. That is not the gospel. That is colonization, wearing a collar. I am not an alcoholic. I broke that cycle, thank God. But the fear, it creeps in still, darkly sometimes, end times, wrath, the sky going black, and I have to reckon with it, consciously, deliberately, every time it rises. I have to separate what was done to my grandmother, to my people, from the faith itself, because faith itself is not the enemy. It never was. They used it as one. They took something sacred and turned it into a leash. They struck the fear of God into a generation of children, punished them for speaking their own languages, tore them from their brothers, trained them to be small and compliant and terrified, and then they handed it down and down and down. My kokum carried it her whole life, the terror and the devotion so tangled she couldn't separate them. So she swung between them, bender to repentance to bender, on and on, until there was nothing left but the end. But at the end, Cree. At the end, blessing. At the end, her. That's the part I hold on to, that the truth of who she was outlasted everything they tried to do to her. That love survived, that the language survived, that something in her, the deep down holy part that no institution could ever actually reach, came back. I think about that on Sundays when the fear tries to creep in. I think about my kokum's voice going soft and ancient and true at the very end. And I think, this is what God sounds like. Not the strap, not the Latin, not the hellfire in the end of days. Her voice, full of Cree, blessing her children. That is what was always ours.
We didn't need any book. Then the Great Spirit met the Great Lie. Indians are Jesus, hanging from the cross, hanging from the cross, in the name of their Savior, forcing on us the Trinity of the chain, guilt, sin, and blame. The Trinity of the chain, guilt, sin, and blame, hanging from the cross, hanging from the cross. In a delusional grandeur, they lie to us, then lie to themselves about lying to us, about lying to us. Hang from the cross, hang from the cross. In the name of the mother, the child, and the human spirit, Indians are Jesus. Hang from the cross, hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. Damnation or salvation. Among the terrorisms of freedom, a civilizing process where the rule of law is the law of rule. The law is a lie. The law is a lie. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. Their ego empire. The ethnic rich. Their cruelty of class. Imitation opulence. Crumbs that look like cake to the masses. Cake to the masses. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. We don't care who they think they are. They look like treaty makers to us, making one more promise, so they'll have another promise to break. Another promise to break. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. They keep asking us, what's wrong with us? We keep saying back, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you is what's wrong with us. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. Indians are Jesus. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. In the name of the mother, the child, and the human spirit. Indians are Jesus. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross.
Hang from the cross.
We weren't lost. And we didn't need any book.
John Trudell from the Santee Sioux Nation, Hanging from the Cross, from his great CD, Bone Days. Well, I have another boarding school story I want to share with you, because it's, you know, everyone has their own story, and then my final story is you know, the positive things that are happening. But this is from Richard Sherman. He's a Native News Son, Today guest columnist. And it's entitled Miles to Go, a Boarding School Tragedy. He said, I recited my first poem in grade school at what was then Kyle Day School. The poem contained only four stanzas. The poet was Robert Frost. It was entitled Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. It resonated with me because as a young man hunting for family, I was accustomed to walking miles before arriving home by nightfall. I was drawn to the final stanza, which went something like this. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. In my youthful innocence, I didn't realize that sleep was a metaphor for death. Frost was saying he had many commitments to fulfill before laying down for his final rest. I'm much older now, and as I reread the poem, as the years roll by, interpretations change. The simplicity of youth gives way to something deeper, something shaped by experience. My new understanding transported me back to a tragic incident that happened during my boarding school days in the 1950s. It involved four little grade school girls who ran away from the boarding school at Pine Ridge. In their desperation to get home, they made decisions that eventually led to their demise. This story is based on actual events. The names are fictitious. Boarding schools and tragedy seem to go hand in hand. The one at Pine Ridge was no exception. It was bedtime in the little girls' wing of the building. Their matron helped them get ready for bed. When the girls were settled in for the night, a final bed check was done and the lights were turned off. The matron's apartment was adjacent to the little girl's wing, allowing her to quickly respond to their needs if necessary. Nights were brutal for some of the girls, who were lonely and wished for nothing more than to be home with their loving families and familiar things. Every evening, the matron heard soft, plaintive cries among the children as they drifted off to sleep. You know, I just want to interject here because, you know, when I was reading this and I'm reading about, you know, how they were treated and And you think, oh, well, you know, why would I want to read this? You know, I know that's in people's heads, you know, like, oh, that happened a while ago. Yes, it did. And it's happening today, just in different ways. Separating the children from their families and putting them in these detention camps. It's no different. They're still doing the same thing today in just a different way. To continue. Nights were brutal for some of the girls who were lonely and wished for nothing more than to be home with their loving families and familiar things. Every evening, the matron heard soft, plaintive cries among the children as they drifted off to sleep. Three of the girls lived near Matteson along Wounded Knee Creek. Ruth and Karen were cousins. A third girl, Annie, was a close friend. When a school bully threatened one of them, she had to deal with all three. They always looked out for each other. They suffered daily from loneliness, their thoughts fixed on home and family. Boarding school life with its endless rules and rigid routines was entirely foreign to their way of life. One morning, during breakfast, the three girls began formulating a plan to run away from school and somehow make their way home. The very thought of it stirred excitement in them. They decided not to take the main road home because searchers would look there first. Their only option was to cut across open country and move quickly enough to arrive home by day's end. What they didn't know was that route they chose was nearly 20 miles long and would take them through open, hilly grassland and then into a maze of deep canyons clad in ponderosa pine. There were no occupied dwellings along the way where they might find relief from the wind, cold, hunger, or fatigue. And once they started, they would be committed to carrying it through to the end. On the day the girls planned to leave, it was an overcast late autumn day with a brisk, steady wind coming out of the north-northwest. The days were cold, the nights freezing. They dressed in their warmest clothing and took whatever food they could gather from the dining hall. After a quick breakfast, the three girls hurried back to the dormitory to change clothes. In their haste to leave, they didn't consider that with an overcast sky, failing to reach home before sundown would mean total darkness, and without the moon and stars to guide them, they would be essentially blind. Leaving the dorm, the girls casually made their way down the sidewalk along the perimeter of the campus, trying to give the impression that they were simply on their way to class. Up ahead, they could see the bridge where cars crossed White Clay Creek. They looked around to see if anyone was watching. When they felt the coast was clear, they ran across the road and dropped down to the creek bottom, where bushes hid them from view. Leaving their books and tablets behind, they continued down the creek until it turned sharply north. From there, they turned east and traveled along the edge of town until they reached the Sundance grounds on the eastern limit of the village. They were astute enough to know that from there the wind was their only compass. At this time of year, it blew steadily from the north, so feeding the wind on the left side of their faces told them they were headed in the right direction. Just beyond the Sundance grounds was a single log house with a sod roof and an outhouse nearby, both sheltered by a small grove of trees. An elderly woman emerged from the outhouse with a dark shawl draped over her head and upper body. Bent and walking slowly with the cane, she ambled down the path toward the house. Along the way, she turned her head and exchanged glances with the girls. Her look was one of concern, while the girls merely smiled and continued, walking briskly as though they were in a hurry. She knew instantly they were runaways and they would be in danger by nightfall if they continued in the direction they were headed. She realized they were not prepared for freezing temperatures. Her son had gone to town for a car part. When he returned, she instructed him to go to the police station to alert them about the runaways, then to the boarding school to inform the officials there. It wasn't long before a search party was organized. Pickup trucks were chained, horses were saddled, and a group of men volunteered to strike out on foot. After receiving final directions from the elderly woman, the men made haste for the hills with high hopes of finding the girls and returning them safely before nightfall. It was not meant to be. The searchers noticed the girls were on a correct heading to get home. With more daylight hours, they might have succeeded, but this time of year, days were short. Some of the men rushed by car to the location they believed the girls would eventually reach their home. With luck, they hoped to find them somewhere between the two search parties. The men were relentless until failing light forced them to stop. They would continue at first light. Two of the men, George and Eldon, who chose to search on foot, both had children of their own and feared the girls would not survive the night. They were anxious to begin searching at dawn, so they built a large fire and fed it all night to keep warm, to maybe attract the girls if they were close enough to see it. A tall, thick red grass grows in clusters throughout the prairie grassland and around timber edges. It serves an important purpose for wildlife. Deer bed down in it to escape the ravages of wind and weather. It would serve runaways in a similar way. When the girls needed to rest, they lay down in the red grass for a few minutes, huddling closely together for warmth. They were careful not to fall asleep, as they had too far to travel. As they continued through their brisk hike, they noticed Annie, the smallest among them, stumbling and falling more often. She began falling further behind until she finally admitted she could go no further. She told Ruth and Karen to continue, and she would catch up when they stopped to rest. She had no way of knowing that when she fell asleep, it would be a deep, final sleep. She lay down in a fetal position in the tall red grass, with her knees drawn up against her chest. The strong wind passed above her while it merely whispered through the grasses where she lay. Ruth and Karen grew concerned as the light faded and they were still far from home. When night fell, it would bring freezing cold. Karen was next to succumb to fatigue and cold. Before she lay down in the tall grass, she turned to Ruth and said, "When you get home, tell them to hurry and come get us." Ruth promised she would, knowing she was their only hope. Ruth struggled alone, guided only by gray streak across the western horizon. When she thought she could suffer no more, she imagined stepping onto the main road a short distance from home. She imagined a dog barking, then recognizing her and running up, squealing and jumping. She imagined the door opening and her mother stepping out, warm air spilling from the house as she embraced her tightly. Quote, "I'm so happy to see you, daughter. I missed you every day," she imagined her saying. Ruth sobbed openly against her mother's breast. The reality, however, was that Ruth was miles from home. She spent every ounce of energy she could muster, then collapsed unconscious on the trail. Sometime during the night, the three girls entered the spirit world, witnessed only by the north wind. Their bodies did not survive, but their spirits lived on. They had entered a different level of consciousness. They were every bit as alive as when they felt the grass under their feet during their time on Earth. During the night, the searchers' wives prepared sandwiches and thermoses for coffee for the next day. At first light, the searchers spread out the width of a quarter mile and continued northeast, the direction the girls had been traveling. Before noon, three spaced shots rang out from somewhere along the line, signaling a body had been found. The searchers converged on the spot. What they saw was a tiny body, curled up tight, frozen to the ground in a patch of tall red grass. Two of the men choked back sobs while others let their tears flow freely. The little girl's body was wrapped in blankets and placed in a vehicle as the search continued. The searchers had no difficulty finding the other two girls. The second was also found in tall grass, the third out in the open. The three girls were taken to a border town where their bodies were prepared for burial. After a two-day wake, they were buried side by side, together as they were in life, once again, in the spirit world. Ruth's mother later told me, the other two mothers, told the other two mothers that on the night the children died, her daughter came to her in a dream. They had miles to go, and then they slept.
I've been living here inside these walls. Do you even care a thing at all where the children are?
That is a song called Take Me Home from a group called Indian City. Well, I want to share this with you because, and it's from Brandy. She says, across North America, indigenous nations are reclaiming their territories through legislation, conservation deals, court victories, and the quiet conscience of everyday people. Here's everything that's happened, why it's changed. The land was always indigenous. That's not a political statement. That's history. And what I'm about to lay out for you is proof that even the colonial machine, slowly and perfectly, sometimes reluctantly, is starting to act like it. Something has shifted. In the past few years, the land back movement has moved off the spray-painted overpass and into the legislation, into the courtroom, into the hands of Catholic nuns on a Wisconsin lakeshore who looked at their property deed and decided they couldn't live with what it represented, and to the conscience of a Pennsylvania farmer who spent years tracing the history of an arrowhead. He found arrowheads as he found as a boy, tracked down the Lenape people his government had forcibly removed to Oklahoma and gave the land back. This is a sweeping continent-wide reckoning. It's happening in California, Redwood Country, and on the shores of Haida. In the Midwest and on the banks of the Klamath River, in Berkeley City Council chambers and on the floor of the Illinois legislature, millions of acres are moving back into indigenous hands through deals struck over decades, through tribal sovereignty being recognized for the first time, and through the ordinary people choosing to do the right thing. She says, I've been tracking every significant land transfer I could find across the U.S. and Canada, from the most recent to the ones that built the foundation we're standing on. What follows is the most comprehensive roundup I know of. Let it remind you of what is possible. Right now, well, just weeks ago, the Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California completed the purchase of over 10,000 acres of ancestral land from the city of Santa Clara. This is the first of many acquisitions the tribe plans to make through the Washoe Land Trust, a Washoe-led nonprofit they established in 2025 specifically to return ancestral lands to their people. Let's see, there's the Placer Land Trust transferred 308 acres near Forest Hill, California, to the Colfax Todd's Valley Consolidated Tribe, the largest land back project yet between the two partners, funded through CAL FIRE's Forestry Legacy Program. The Washoe Tribe also completed a separate $6 million acquisition of the former Loyalton Ranch, now renamed the Wilmette Preserve, more than 10,000 acres of sagebrush scrublands and pine forests near Lake Tahoe. The purchase tripled the tribe's land base, and a $5.5 million grant from the California Wildlife Conservation Board alongside private donations made it happen. And yes, the Yurok Tribe of May of 2025, the largest land back deal in California history. She says, this is the one people need to know about, and we know about it because we live right so close by. But 23 years in the making, 47,907 acres, the final 14,968-acre phase of the Blue Creek watershed, home to salmon runs, old-growth forest, and Yurok sacred sites along the Klamath River, was officially transferred to the Yurok Tribe on May 30th of 2025. At a purchase price of $56 million, it is the largest single land return in California history. The transfer more than doubled Yurok's land holdings, land the tribe has been dispossessed for nearly a century while timber companies logged it raw. As Tribal Chairman Joseph James said, we are forging a sustainable future for the fish, forests, and our people that honors both ecological integrity and our culture. And the deal was achieved in partnership with the Western Rivers Conservancy. They spent 2 years acquiring the land in phases from Green Diamond Resource Company before turning it over to the tribe. Let's see. In October of 2025, the Tule River Indian Tribe of California acquired 17,000 acres in the Sierra Nevada. The same week, the nuns made history in Wisconsin. Something equally significant was happening in the California Central Valley. Governor Calvin Newsom announced the return of 17,030 acres of ancestral land to the Tule River Indian Tribe in the Sierra Nevada foothills, the largest ancestral land returned in that region's history. The land includes the former Hershey and Carruthers Ranches and the Middle Deer Creek Watershed, one of the last undammed waterways in the southern Sierra Nevada. The transfer expanded the tribe's reservation to more than 72,000 acres. And their tribal chairman said the tribe envisions this land located in the Yalome Hills as a place to gather, heal, and simply be. The return came with something else, the reintroduction of Tule elk, absent from those foothills for decades, alongside ongoing restoration of beavers and protection of California condor habitat. And the tribe has been reweaving an entire ecosystem back together. And the acquisition was facilitated by the Conservation Fund and funded through state conservation programs and private philanthropic partners. On Halloween, on the shores of the Trout Lake in Arborville, Wisconsin, an order of Catholic nuns made history. The Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration transferred their Marywood Franciscan Spirituality Center, a lakefront property with four cabins, an office building, and a lodge, back to the Lac du Flambeau brand of the Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. They sold it for $30,000, the same price they paid in 1966, roughly 1% of its current market value. This is believed to be the first land returned by a Catholic religious order in the history of the United States. The Catholic Church is one of the largest non-governmental landowners on earth and received thousands of acres of native land free of charge from the federal government during the allotment era. The sisters had spent 2 years in political education through the organization Land Justice Futures before the transfer. Brittany Coteles, the co-founder, said, quote, "They're setting a precedent for the largest private landowner in the world, the Catholic Church, and that a huge invitation to healing that I could hope to see continue to grow and ripple out." And the tribe plans to use the site for spiritual gatherings. Let's see, Canada's Supreme Court rejected an appeal from the town of Southampton upholding the Saugeen First Nations claim to a stretch of sacred Lake Huron shoreline that the federal government had wrongfully excluded from their territory for generations. The beach was formally returned. The nation chose to keep it open for community gatherings. Let's see, the Prairie Band of Potawatomi Nation in Illinois. More than 175 years after the reservation was illegally auctioned off by the U.S. government while Chief Saab Inai was away from his territory, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker signed legislation authorizing the transfer of the Saubona Lake State Park, 1,500 acres in DeKalb County, back to the Prairie Band of Potawatomi Indians. A year earlier, the U.S. Department of Interior had placed the tribe's Illinois land into federal trust, making the Prairie Band the first federally recognized tribal nation in the state. There was no federally recognized reservations in Illinois before that. Okay, the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina acquired its first significant land holding, 1,328 acres of forested wetlands transferred from the Open Space Institute. On Haida Nation in the community of Haiga Gilda Skidgate, Prime Minister Trudeau in Canada attended, this was in February of 2025, attended a ceremony celebrating the signing of the translates to Big Tide, Low Water, Haida Title Lands Agreement. The Haida citizens had voted 97% in favor. It was the first time in history that Canada negotiated recognition of Aboriginal title to specific lands. The Haida didn't need a court to tell them they were what they already knew, and eventually the Crown caught on. Let's see, in Massachusetts, the W.D. Cowles Incorporated, one of Massachusetts' oldest private lumber companies, donated 500 acres of forested land connected to Mount Tubby in Sutherland to the Hassanamisco Nipmuc Band. The company's representative said, quote, "This land belongs in the care of the native people whose stewardship practices are rooted in respect for the earth. I'm honored to play a small role in the historic movement." In November of 2024, Brown University agreed to transfer 255 acres of its historic Mount Hope property in Bristol, Rhode Island, to a preservation trust established by the Pocanocut Indian Tribe. The land is the ancestral home of Metacom, King Philip, leader of the Pocahontas people, and the site of his death in 1676. An additional 120 acres were sold to the town of Bristol for conservation. The Coachella Valley Mountains Conservancy transferred 656 acres in Upper Palm Canyon near Palm Springs back to the Agua Caliente Band of Coahuila Indians. Combined with earlier transfers, more than 1,200 acres have been returned to the tribe since 2024. Let's see, the Mount Shasta. For over a century, the Shasta Indian Nation's most sacred lands lay underneath, flooded by the Kokopo Dam built in the early 1900s. The people forced off by eminent domain, their fishing sites and ceremonial grounds swallowed by a reservoir. The tribe has had no land base since, and that changed in June of 2024 when Governor Newsom announced California was working with the Shasta Indian Nation to transfer 2,820 acres in Siskiyou County back to the tribe. Let's see, there's the Upper Sioux community in Minnesota. The state of Minnesota returned the land formerly known as the Upper Sioux Agency State Park, approximately 1,200 acres of Dakota Territory, to the Upper Sioux community. This was land the Dakota had been exiled from in 1862. Save the Redwoods League signed a historic agreement to convey the OU site in Ora, California, to the Yurok tribe. And that has been completed, because I know that they just opened that recently, just in, maybe in the last couple of weeks. Also, the Berkeley City Council voted unanimously to purchase and return the West Berkeley Shell Mound and Village site to the Songoriete Land Trust, a Native woman-led organization associated with the Confederated Villages of the Lishan Nation. Berkeley became one of the first cities in California to return land to a tribal entity. The University of Minnesota announced a plan to return 3,400 acres of the Cloquet Forestry Center lands to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. A partnership within the state wildlife conservation and the Sierra Nevada Conservancy helped the Tubalutubal tribe acquire 1,240 acres of ancestral land bordering the Sequoia National Forest. Tribal chairman said the site would be the nucleus of everything we do from now on. The Department of the Interior concluded a decade-long land buyback program for tribal nations. Nearly 3 million acres across 15 states consolidated and restored to tribal land. And then there's the Gabrielino Shoshone Nation. 20 acres in Los Angeles were officially returned to them. At the time, the largest land restoration. This was in September of 2023. And then there's more about the private companies, you know, and individuals, including that farmer who found the arrowheads and started looking into the history and then gave back the land. And, you know, it's a positive, you know, after you hear all the tragedy and the suffering, to know that the land is giving back. And I've always said, you know, we're living on the edge of the earth. We really are. And what's holding it back, what's keeping it from falling over, are the prayers and the culture of indigenous people all over this world. And that is why it is so important that we understand. And the land back, when everything else is burnt and destroyed, and there's nothing left for our children, everyone will be looking to the indigenous people who still hold some crumbs. And remember, this is your voice in the Redwoods, KMUD Radio.
Lumbuck, the colonize the earth where you mind that. Indigenous soul, very fine that. All I want a world in alignment. Lumbuck, Lumbuck, the colonize the earth where you mind that. All I want a world in alignment. See the new dawn on the horizon. Not for sale, cause creation free. Water, air, and land, commodity. What the farmer seed, that's the pharmacy. Solidarity, the people's sovereignty. Remember that food that we used to grow, in names and a language that we used to know. Indigenous stewards of the natural. Rest
through the second hoop for survival. Being a billionaire is not brilliant. Money print every day, more presidents. There's still reservations on the continent. We relatives, they still call us savages. Community, that remedy. Their medicine, please, your humility. Land trust, show me tax or security. Sacred sites, all nations coordinate. Lambak. The galanize the earth for your mind that all around the world in alignment. See the new dawn on the horizon.
I'm one at the Adlishan Norwan. Dini Ogwe Adhinan. Dini Shawe Adhishan. I'm Kimetka. Dini no no Amuagma. Dini no ma atupenta. Boshe Hushi Tushta.
We're dependent on our mother, we are not the owners. And for us to coexist, we got to get to know her. Language and the land shape each other over time. Native tongues wake up medicine deep inside. We were stolen from her lands, now she wants us back. Native ceremonies help get us back on track. There is nothing that could keep us from our sacred places. Ancestors calling us, they recognize our faces. Real question is, do we recognize ourselves? Or do we fight over who suffered more from what was dealt? The solution is more than acquired wealth. What we need is a higher quality of health. Everybody benefits from growing native seeds. Every ecosystem thrives in diversity. Native voices rise up for the comeback. Give us back to the land, do we heal that?
Rematriation, repatriation, reparation, regeneration. Worldwide liberation, worldwide illumination. Rematriation, repatriation, reparation, regeneration. Worldwide liberation, worldwide illumination. Lambak. Colonize the earth for your mind that indigenous soul pray we find that. All around the world in alignment. Lambak. Colonize the earth for your mind that all around the world in alignment. See the new dawn on the horizon.
Remember those seeds that we used to sow. Pass through the dreams that we used to know. Remember those ways of the natural. Giving our praise to the material. Lineage, it can never be material. Object, no profit, no cereal. Codes can be placed on the elements. We show nothing but respect to our relatives. To maintain life, that's so relevant. No corporation should be selling it. With the hands in the pockets of the lobbyists. We stand with the people, no politics. Restoration, the new prerogative. Only take what we need and leave offerings. All the nations play a part in this. Set up ancient trade routes across continents.
Nanbak is when people get smart. When they get smart, they humble themselves and they realize the destruction that they've caused, maybe unintentionally. The mining, the dams, the pipelines has a cumulative effect, and that effect is devastating. And by returning the land to the people who were chosen by Creator to steward those lands in our own way, we can reestablish the guidelines so we can reincorporate safety measures, so we can develop codes to protect these waters. It's not just about returning the land, it's much more than that. And then our future will be secured.
This has been a K-Mite podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.